Welcome back to Crackcast.
Chapter 30, episode 30, GI bleeding.
This
one's
second round.
Right? Second round. This one's money, guys. So, Chris, start us off with our signpost.
Number one, list five causes of upper GI bleeding in adults and peds.
Number two, list five causes of lower GI bleeds in peds and adults.
Number trois, describe your management approach for severe upper GI bleeding.
That's an important one. Number four, list six low-risk criteria for discharge home if you're having a little bleed from the bum or the top.
And then my favorite, list the components of the Rockall and Glasgow Blatchford score.
That's your favorite, Chris.
It's not a geography question.
Yeah, okay. Wisecracks, we're going to describe the insertion of the infamous Blakemore tube.
That's awesome. And then not so awesome. Six causes of false positive stool guaiac.
Boring. Or like Chris likes to say, why you shouldn't use the test in the first place. All right, let's rip it up, Chris.
So there's lots of GI bleeds. We see them fairly frequently. And we need to think about risk factors that predispose people for GI bleeding. So I think about medication factors and I think about historical things. So medication-wise, obviously anything that causes your coagulation system to change, so aspirin, and then NSAIDs are going to decrease your protection around the gastric mucosa. Things like steroids, anticoagulants, the novel ones and the old ones, and then chemotherapeutic agents.
And yeah, the big ones there are your NSAIDs. They are by far the largest cause of GI bleeds in North America every year. So that's a big thing. Always remember to ask.
And then historically, think about liver, think about age, think about kidneys, and then comorbidities. So previous history of peptic ulcer disease, known liver disease or cirrhosis, age over 60, alcoholism, smoking, comorbidities like diabetes or renal failure. And then don't forget this juicy pearl. Somebody who has had previous aneurysmal graft surgery.
And why is that important? Because they're bleeding from their aorta into their intestine.
The old aortoenteric fistula.
Problem. So from that one, guys, to summarize, I'm going to take some big points out of there. So on history and kind of risk factors. So NSAID use, anticoagulant use, history of known ulcer disease, known liver disease or cirrhosis, same. If they're old or if they're frail, if they're a big boozer, if there's a history of abdominal aortic aneurysm graft, that's all.
Mm-hmm. So upper versus lower, this is a key dichotomy. We love dichotomies in medicine. They help us categorize our thinking. So upper is anything above the ligaments of Treitz.
To me, I'm not that smart. I can't remember where that is. So basically it's distal duodenum. So anything proximal to that is an upper GI bleed. Anything distal to that is a lower GI bleed.
And upper has a higher mortality, so yeah. Around 12 to 14%. Lower is lower mortality, like 4%. So clinically, what do we characterize each of these bleeds by?
So there's kind of classic signs and symptoms, but with upper GI bleeds, we really talk about hematemesis, so coffee ground emesis, and melena, so dark, tarry, nasty smelling stools, with a high BUN in the setting of no renal failure. So if there's coffee coming up the mouth end and there's black Oreo looking stuff coming out the bottom end and their BUN and hemoglobin is low and BUN high, problem, probably got a GI bleed.
And remember, melena is black tarry. So tarry means sticky.
It's not a dark stool. Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be black as black.
Black. And then lower GI bleeds, here we think hematochezia. So that's a bright red per rectum versus maroon stools. Same. It's just how long the blood's been hanging around.
So we worry about two major causes of upper GI bleeding. These ones are the ones that are life-threatening and cause serious massive hemorrhagic shock. The first one is anybody with a variceal bleed, either esophageal or gastric. The second would be the aortoenteric fistula. So we think they have an upper or lower GI bleed, but what should we rule out, Adam?
Sneaky. There's some important mimics here. So think upper versus lower GI mimics, epistaxis, hemoptysis, dental bleeds, red food coloring, bismuth or iron supplements. So that 12-year-old boy who is drinking a lot of Gatorade and throwing up and mom thinks it's blood might be the red Gatorade.
The old red Gatorade.
And then those lower GI bleed mimics, Chris?
So anything from the bottom end. So this is particularly important in the geriatric population where their tens is all bloody and what the source is still to be determined. So when you think about in women, vaginal bleeding, and then we also think about gross hematuria in men or female. And then don't forget about things that make your poop red.
Like what?
Like beets.
The good old beets.
And blueberries can make them black and other stuff.
Like a whole case of Oreos. Personal experience, you're like a greedy little post-call dude. You eat a whole box of Oreos, your poop's gonna be black.
So let's get on to the questions here. So number one, list five causes of upper GI bleeding in adults and pediatrics.
I'll take the adults because it's easier. So ready in order of most common to least common. Follow along in table 30-1 if you're a visual kind of person. Peptic ulcer disease, so whether that's gastric, which is more common than duodenal ulcers. Gastric erosions, esophageal gastric varices, so meaning varices in the esophagus or the stomach. Mallory Weiss tears, esophagitis or gastric cancer.
And then in the kiddies, we're thinking about number one, duodenal ulcers, gastric ulcers, esophagitis or gastric erosions, and then less common, esophageal varices and Mallory Weiss tears. As you notice, the lists overlap quite a bit. Essentially, anything that breaks down your mucosa or backs your blood flow or leads to major sort of structural damage like a tear or a tumor are the common causes.
Nice. Question number two. We're moving along here. List five causes, Dr. Lip, of lower GI bleeds in adult and peds. Let's give you adults this time.
All right. So adults. So I think about the painless causes. So diverticular disease, angiodysplasia. And then I think about maybe the more irritant causes. So colitis. So inflammatory, infectious, or ischemic colitis. Don't forget that bowel ischemia as a cause. And then anorectal sources such as anal fissures or external hemorrhoids. And then things we need to worry about in the older people, neoplasms. And then don't forget a brisk upper GI bleed.
And they're dying in front of you if it's a truly brisk upper GI bleed. Now, peds, we've got our, again, in the most common to least common, anal rectal fissure, infectious colitis, inflammatory bowel disease, juvenile polyps, intussusception, that's a big one, and Meckel's diverticulum.
So yeah, don't forget those congenital ones, the polyps, intus, and the Meckel's.
Intus, is that, that's a new abbreviation?
Yeah, it's abbreviation.
This kid's got the intus, got it.
So number three, describe your management approach for severe upper GI bleeding.
These people are sick, so you guys know this. It's the movie and go from there. So first, we're going to see, are they GI bleed or not? Are they stable or not? So get some vital signs. Take a look at your patient. They don't look so bueno. Then it's two large bore IVs. Get the fluid running. Get the blood ready. Get that hemoglobin cross-match and coags started right away. And start your resuscitation. Once you kind of level them out, what are you going to do, Chris?
Yeah, so while I'm trying to stabilize them, I'm trying to think in my mind that nice dichotomy. Is it an upper GI bleed or is it a lower GI bleed? Because management differs. Obviously, if they're unstable and it's an upper GI bleed, you need to think about airway management as your first priority. So you want to intubate them as needed to prevent them from aspirating on their hematemesis. Remember that if they're super shocky, you want to be very careful that you don't use your laryngoscopy as a murder weapon, as Scott Weingart says. Make sure you fill the tank up before you paralyze. If you're not comfortable paralyzing them and they need the tube, you better think about doing a wake look and keep them at what angle roughly?
Up, you know, whatever angle you can, but more than 45 degrees preferably. So we're trying to decrease that pressure on the lower esophageal sphincter so that they don't get this volcano of badness coming into the mouth. And if you can, try not to paralyze them.
Yeah, exactly. What I always thought is you have to lie the patients flat on their back. And that's actually not the case. You can intubate so many people lying at 30 degrees, 45 degrees in the OR. The people are stable. We're talking about the emerge where things is crazy.
Anarchy.
So you want to do the characterization. If it's upper, you want to think about airway, breathing, circulation. I've heard that before somewhere.
A couple times.
And then we'll talk about the scoring criteria for whether or not they need admission. Pretty simple. upper severe GI bleeding is common in the hospital.
Yeah, tube them, resuscitate them, large bore, get the level one going, make sure they don't get coagulopathic, and then talk to our colleagues in gastroenterology. They need definitive management. So whether that's get a camera down there and treat them, or get a CTA and then get IR to embolize, or if it's really bad, they go to the OR and they get everything oversewn by the surgeons.
And then the lower GI bleeding, do they need admission to the floor, or do they just need outpatient GI follow-up for possible and lower endoscopy or anoscopy?
I like that. In summary, bad GI bleed, intubate if you think you need airway protection, resuscitate with a one-to-one-to-one blood product strategy, and then figure out what end it's coming from.
All right, number four, the six low-risk criteria for discharge home in GI bleeds.
Basically, they have to be the healthiest person ever, looking great, for you to fire them on the way.
Yeah, so it's not a perfect rule. Really, according to Rosen's, they need nothing wrong with them to go home.
Basically, they need to not be bleeding.
Yeah, so that's an idealistic perspective. The six things here are no comorbid diseases, normal vital signs, normal or trace results in stool guaiac testing, normal hemoglobin, proper understanding of signs and symptoms of significant bleeding and when to return, and then immediate access to emergent care. So if they're on some remote island off the Sunshine Coast here, probably shouldn't go home without some good follow-up.
Yeah, that applies to a lot of people, right? So if there's someone that you can't trust, or they're in a non-fixed address or can't get access to emergency care, if they start volcano bleeding everywhere, then you just have to admit them for observation and workup.
So thankfully, we have the next question covering some of these scores.
Nice. Oh, and let's just add, so that's all for upper GI bleeds, right? For lower GI bleeds, basically, they're going to admit to the hospital from Rosen's perspective if it's not clearly from hemorrhoids, fissure, or proctitis. And that's just because it hasn't been well studied. But I have to say, our local practice, that's not really what happens a lot. But, you know.
You're holding me back from these scores.
I'm sorry.
These things are so exciting.
Excited. Question number five, Chris. Unleash the beast. Tell us about the Rockall score.
So the Rockall score has a 90% sensitivity, but it includes endoscopy. So it's not super helpful for us unless you're somebody with a fellowship training in upper endoscopy and emerge, which would be...
You're not?
Well, I'm working on it.
Okay.
I'm working on my scopes. I have to get 50 before I'm certified. So it's scored as per table 34 based on two variables, age and shock, degree of shock or sickness. So it's scored from 0 to 3, and it's pretty simple. Anybody who has a score more than 0 are considered high risk for developing adverse outcomes. So if you're less than 60 with normal vitals, you have a score of 0. As soon as you go above 60, your score increases. So it looks at a heart rate over 100 beats per minute, systolic blood pressure less than 100, any comorbidities such as CHF, renal failure, liver failure, malignancy, as well as the age factor. The higher you go, the higher score gets.
Boom.
It's not the most helpful score. So probably the easiest way to think about it is if the person is less than 60 with normal vitals and no comorbidities, then the Rockall score is probably 0.
Intuitive.
Now the Blatchford score.
This one's complicated. We don't need to flog the horse on this one. If you really want specifics, look at table 30-3. The ideal part of Blatchford score is it's been found to be more sensitive. So it's 99.6%. Sensitive, does not take into account endoscopy. Here it incorporates their BUN level, their hemoglobin level that's stratified by gender, what their systolic blood pressure is, and then other markers. So pulse, is there presence of melena, syncope, are they comorbid disease with hepatic or heart failure? The range is from 0 to 23. And basically anybody with a score, again, higher than 0, they're too high risk to go home.
So it's pretty easy. If you get asked this question in real life, if they have any vital sign, historical, or lab abnormality, their score is automatically over 0 and they're high risk.
Which intuition says we need to figure them out anyways. So admit them, have your GI colleagues take a look.
All right, we're on to wisecracks. And this is the fun part.
The Blake Bowl War.
So how do we do this?
So if you guys want an in-depth, awesome video of how to insert a Blakemore tube, go over to MCRIT under the procedures tab, take a look at Blakemore tube placement, because it gets kind of complicated with the audio, me trying to tell you to mark the balloons and that kind of thing. But take a look at the tab. This is straight off the MCRIT website. So what you're going to do is you're going to secure that airway, because don't be inserting a Blakemore with someone who's breathing on their own and aspirating everything. That's a bad idea. So patient should be intubated, head up, bed up at 45 degrees, like we just said. Then you're going to check out your balloons. Make sure they fully inflate and deflate. So there's two balloons there. There's the gastric and the esophageal balloon. You're going to mark the Blakemore at 50 centimeter mark from Blakemore with the tip of 2 centimeters above the gastric balloon and then 2 centimeters above the esophageal. I got really confused, but take a look of the photo on MCRIT's website. Basically, you fold the thing in half, you mark it at 50 centimeters, the halfway mark, so you know where you're going to be close to the stomach. And then that lets you know the distance from the gastric balloon to the esophageal. Chris, what do we do after that?
So once you mark the tubes, or the marks on the Blakemore tube, you want to test the balloons, make sure they have good integrity, and then you're going to be inserting the Blakemore tube through the mouth, like an OG tube. You might need the laryngoscope or McGill forceps to help get the tube in the esophagus.
Because it's not the smallest thing ever.
So you're going to stop at the first 50 centimeter marker, and then you want to insert a small amount of air or saline into the gastric port while listening over the stomach and then the lungs. And then before you put any more in, you want to confirm that you're in the stomach. We don't want to place it in the esophagus or pop.
And by pop, Chris means rupture of the esophagus and bleeding into mediastinum. Problem.
Bad. So you're in the stomach. You've confirmed on an x-ray. Then you inflate it with another 200 mils. And then you put traction on the Blakemore tube using 1 kilogram of mass, or you can use a liter of saline hung over an IV. Yeah,
exactly. I never know what's 1 kilogram of mass. Just take a full bag of normal saline and hang that over the pole.
It's probably not even the right terminology. Anyway, so you stretch the tube, you put pressure on this gastric varices, and then you want to troubleshoot. If the person's still bleeding, you want to think about maybe washing the stomach out, decompressing the stomach, making sure there's no more large volume that's expanding the stomach causing active bleeding. If they're still bleeding, then you think about inflating the second balloon. That's the esophageal balloon.
This is when your sphincter tone should be getting higher, because this is already a Hail Mary and the first Hail Mary didn't work. So now we got to go on to the second. So basically you inflate the esophageal balloon with a manometer attached to a three-way stopcock. Take a look on the MCRIT site again with the video. It makes sense. But this is a really elegant way to make sure that you're not applying too much pressure to rupture the esophagus. So inflate it up to 30. If they're still bleeding after 30 millimeters of mercury, you got a problem. You can go up to 45, but you are a cowboy if you're inflating past 45. You better have a thoracic surgeon around if that's happening.
Yeah, and of course, through all this, you're going to be paging GI, asking them to come in and take care of this patient. So, like we said, for the fifth time, check out the MCRIT or check out some other resource. I just want to walk through the steps with you again and just mentally simulate what you'll be doing as you insert it. So this is broad terms here. The patients who be intubated with the head of their bed up, you're going to be testing the balloons and marking them. So intubate, head of bed up, test and mark, insert the Blakemore tube through the mouth, stop at the 50 centimeter mark, put 50 mils in, listen and confirm with chest x-ray that you're in the stomach, then inflate the gastric balloon. If they're still bleeding after decompressing that, you want to think about inflating the esophageal balloon and then making sure you're doing it right with the right pressures, the right volumes.
And then in the end, either link them up to the old football helmet or get that fancy ETAD device. That's it. That's the Blakemore. I've done a couple. They're fun. One was just because endoscopy failed. The other one, I think, was just because we didn't know what was going on. Have you done one yet, Chris?
Never have done one.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's going to be in my future days, hopefully. Who knows? Just to remind you that there are other options if the person's massively bleeding. You want to think about maybe interventional radiology. Can they isolate the bleeding vessel? And then if all else fails, maybe they need a esophagectomy. So that you should call general thoracic surgery.
Last question, guys. Wisecracks number 2 lists 6 causes of the false positive stool guaiac. Chris, you hate this test, so take it away, my friend.
So anything that triggers this guaiac to turn positive is going to make your test not very useful. So things like red meat, turnips, horseradish, vitamin C, methylene blue, and bromide.
Sounds like dinner for you.
Yeah, that's a perfect dinner for me. Has everything, including the methylene blue for the cyanosis, that I'm going to get from, I don't know.
Almonds.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay, guys, that's it. That's GI bleeding. Remember, they look sick. They are sick. So intubate them. Do something about it. Get blood in. Don't wash them out with just crystalloid and ask our colleagues to help out.
GI bleeding out.
Out the Blake Bore. You cut me open and I keep